gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is we don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Linda. Welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Nicola.
Hello.
Teresa.
Hi.
Heather.
Hi.
Pat.
Hello.
And Stephanie.
Hello there.
Full house today. Today, we celebrate a birthday of a very famous writer, William Shakespeare, who was born April 23rd, 1564. So if you're listening out there, Bill, happy birthday from all of us.
Happy birthday, Bill.
The quill, all those books, and only a feather.
That's right. Yeah, marvelous.
This week on Right Club, Nicola is going to read an excerpt from her work in progress. Teresa will give us her word of the week, and we'll spend some time learning more about that oft-repeated instruction, show, no, tell. And Heather and Kirsten Pell will tell us what's on their bedside tables. But first, Pat is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Okay. I think this is quite an easy one. I'm expecting people to get this. If not on the first, then very possibly the second clue. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep.
Okay, it was first published in 1961. It's set in the 30s and features a memorable female protagonist.
Mm. Right.
Mm. I've got an idea.
I've got a few female protagonists.
I was born in 1961.
I thought you were saying the 30s.
Was it you?
Ooh.
Okay. And second clue is actually the first sentence from the novel. The boys, as they talked to the girls from Marcia Blaine School.
Oh, I know.
Stood on the far side of their bicycles, holding the handlebars, which established a protective fence of bicycle between the sexes, and the impression that at any minute the boys were likely to be away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just you and me, Teresa.
What's unusual about that?
Yeah. And okay, I think everybody will get it from this third clue. This short novel was successfully filmed in the early 70s with Maggie Smith portraying the lead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh, no, still Nicola's bit, still looking
before my time,
stumped. Nope. She always delights in telling us that, doesn't she? You noticed.
It's my only defence.
Okay, so I think, Steph, you were first.
It's The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
Yes. Yes, it is. By Muriel Spark.
That's right. Absolutely right.
Okay. So you both got it on the second clue?
We did.
Yeah, we did. I went wrong
they
on
had
the first. I'm not going to tell you what I thought it was because I'm going to use that for my name in the novel.
I love the novel to read, but I also love the film with Maggie Smith. It's a she was my role model for years. Somebody once told me I looked like her in the film.
Oh,
I've done that for ages.
Well, you are an attractive woman, Pat.
Oh, thank you.
If they were telling you you look like the woman who lived in the van, now you'd be a bit more worried.
I probably do now.
No, Muriel Spark's great. I've got a lovely book called An Observing Eye, and it's just a book of quotes by Muriel Spark from all her novels. And she's
now Nicola is going to read for her work in progress the Taurus Trilogy. And I'm eager to know what's happened to that doomed spacecraft.
Okay. Arva crept quickly through the forest, pulling her reluctant little brother, Mahendra, behind her. The light was dim, shot through only by the occasional arrow of sunlight, and the plant spores and insects danced in the streams of gold piercing the gloom. The humidity stuck her simple shift to her back, like it had been chewed and spat on by one of the village elders. With her free hand, she lifted her dark, heavy hair and twisted it on the top of her head to give her neck a momentary breath of coolness. The steady drip of moisture from the branches punctuated the hoots, shrieks and howls of the monkeys far above, swinging from vine to vine as they followed the children through the ancient trees. Arba knew they would take Mahendra if she left him too long, but their presence reassured her that all was well in the jungle. She only needed to worry when they fell silent. The two skinny brown children followed a path of sorts, but it was faint and very overgrown this early after the rains, and as well as looking for landmarks, the older sister had to keep a wary eye out for the other denizens of the forest, who also used the path regularly. The many elephant families were surprisingly silent. You could generally feel them coming by the vibrations of the ground through Abba's bare brown feet. Although Abba's bare brown feet hardly touched the ground in her eagerness to reach her destination without them both being bitten, stung or eaten. Their mummy was a healer and helped women birth their babies. She was so busy nowadays making potions and lotions as the village grew and grew. Abba thought she'd barely notice if she herself was consumed by a fiery tiger or the silently dropping shadow of a black panther. But she certainly wouldn't be happy if Mahendra, the light of her life since his arrival 3 years ago, disappeared. He was such a tasty morsel, though. Boys were different. Abba knew that. While girls were useful for fetching water and chores, one day her brother would join the warriors in the hunting party that fed the whole village with meat. Food had been plentiful in recent years, and the villagers thought that that was entirely due to the occupant of the forest Abba was soon to face. Many of the lush plants along the way were nearly as big as she was, and the leaves were glossy and large enough to wrap yourself in for a welcome nap. But there was no time for sleeping yet. Mami was waiting for the special herbs and plant roots that could only be gathered in the sacred grove in the forest. The villagers gave thanks on every feast day for the grove, little knowing that there were over 14,000 such places on their continent alone, with thousands more spread around the world. Each had been created suddenly on the same day just a few years ago. There, Abba spotted the ancient fallen tree, draped in creepers and covered in fungi the size of elephant ears, that guarded the easiest entrance to the grove. The ground dipped suddenly here, and as the children slipped and skidded down the side of the huge bowl that had been punched into the fertile earth, Abba noticed that the sleeping monster who lived there was even more grown over than last year. His slippery, shiny sides that dimly reflected Arba's face, just like the lake where the crocodiles lurked, were finally giving in to the lichen that covered everything fallen in the forest, and his pointed head with the see-through eyes barely poked out of the climbing vegetation now.
There's some lovely imagery. Really lovely imagery.
Yeah, great description. Very good.
Yeah, the first couple of sentences where the sunlight is piercing the jungle growth is fabulous.
The arrow.
Yeah.
An arrow of light and then right, piercing the green.
Yeah, really lovely. And then after that, the humidity stuck her simple shift to her back like it'd been chewed and spat on by one of the village elders. I love it. It's vivid and original and funny.
I just didn't think it looked like, I mean, I don't know what it would look like to have something chewed up and spat on your back. But I thought if it's perspiration on her back, then that would be more like a wet t-shirt or something.
Yeah.
But how does it look if something is chewed up and spat on?
Well, yeah, I didn't think about how it looked. I thought it was the feeling that she had.
That's what I thought.
All right.
But also, it's kind of in a subtle way telling you something about this culture that has elders.
The context.
Yeah. It's a great show of elders and her position in the culture.
Sitting around chewing beetle and spitting at little girls, perhaps.
Not noticing where the spit was landing, maybe.
I liked it, but I take your point that... If it was, I didn't take it to be a visual image. I took it to be a sense. Yeah,
sensation.
Okay. I'm trying to find the most repulsive thing to describe something stuck to you.
I think it's really good.
Yeah. The bit that kind of jerked me out of, if you like, the fictive dream was where you suddenly tell us that there are 14,000 of these groves and little knowing. And until that point, I was with them. I was on the journey. I was seeing the jungle. I was feeling the humidity. And then suddenly there's this diversion that says, little did they know.
Yes.
And it's almost like the author's intruding.
Yeah, it is.
And saying, forget that story. By the way, there's 14,000.
Right.
So I think maybe that, if we need that information, maybe we could get it somewhere. Somewhere.
Put it somewhere else.
Also,
statistic there.
Because it's all about the when I did my research, I think that this probably is part of the danger of doing all the planning, like the snowflake method planning in advance, because you sort of feel like you have to share the backstory all the time, whereas actually you don't. The backstory is important for me to be able to piece the plot together.
Less is often more.
But I liked the way the tension was conveyed. without it being overdone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quite subtly there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that she was going through doing a dangerous job.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
And she was concerned that her brother would be
stung or eaten. I thought that at first when they found what I now know to be the spaceship was doomed from the last excerpt we had, it's crashed there and covered over with these herbs and whatever. But at first I thought they were I thought it was a big log or something.
Right.
You know, just a big log.
I thought that was very nice, yeah.
Yeah.
You get the sleeping monster with its shiny sides.
Yeah.
And because we limited Nicola to the amount of reading she could do, but it sort of becomes clearer in the next paragraph.
But that's how a child would see that kind of
absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. Right.
But they wouldn't see it as a spaceship. So it's beautiful.
Yeah. Exactly.
And everything is from Abba's point of view.
Abba.
Yeah. Everything's from Abba's point of view, apart from the 14,000 groves little thing. Everything else is from her point of view. And I'm with her and I'm seeing this crashed spaceship that she's interpreting as a monster.
Brilliant. And what I also like is, as a reader, I'm not getting everything spoon-fed. I have to think, like, what is it? Oh, I get it.
Absolutely.
I love that.
Well, do you not worry about he was such a tasty morsel, though?
Again, I love the humour. I love these little touches of humour that come in, and that's very much your style with this book.
Well, I saw a documentary about a South American tribe that used to send the kids off into the jungle to look for tarantulas to bring back to put on their fire. Oh, they used to eat tarantulas. And these things were like the size of plates. Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Yeah. Very tasty.
I was thinking that all over the world, children are going out on messages in dangerous environments.
Yeah.
Right.
It's true to life.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Nicola.
Thank you.
Teresa will share with us a word of the week. Teresa?
Okay, my word of the week this week is nesh. And this is a word that's instantly recognisable to anyone from the north of England, but mystifies others. Linda, have you ever heard of this nesh?
No, I haven't. I was just thinking, though, if we were down home, you could say, there used to be that car, nesh. You could hear maybe Joe Bob saying, "Oh, you know, over there, Jimmy got himself a Nash Rambler."
It's nothing to do with that.
Not Nash.
When we say someone's Nash, we mean they're soft. Someone who feels the cold more than others is a typical example, or doesn't want to play out in the rain, could be called Nash. It seems to come from the old English word, which I don't know how to pronounce, Hneska, so it's Hnesce, meaning feeble, weak, or infirm. Possibly connected to the Dutch word nesch, Nesch, or nish, Nisch, meaning damp, sodden, or foolish. The OED gives the sense lacking courage, spirit, or energy, timid, faint-hearted, lazy, negligent, but also another meaning, mild, gentle, kind, inclined to pity, mercy, as well as easily yielding to temptation, inclined to lust or wantonness. Though the most common sense the OED agrees is in current use is the familiar one of delicate, weak, sickly, feeble, unable to endure fatigue, susceptible to cold, etc. As with many dialect words, it's been in the language a long time. The word appears in the Lindisfarne Gospels. Now, these are beautifully illuminated manuscripts from 8th century Britain. They were produced in the monastery on the Northumbrian island of Lindisfarne. And they're now in the British Museum in London. And while this gives us a date for the first recording of the word, it's not necessarily the earliest date of use. We know it's been in use from the 8th century, but it may be a lot older.
Right, so we're not being rude. We're being historic.
Right.
We call somebody Nesh.
Oh, yeah. You think, okay. Yeah. The part about not liking to go out in the rain. or not want to go out in the cold. I guess I'm a bit neshy that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you're not neshy. You're just neshy.
Oh, no. There's no why.
There's no why on nesh.
Oh, well.
I don't think you can...
You can't be neshy.
Have any endings or anything.
If you said neshy, that's a bit neshy.
Well, if you did something in a nesh way, could you do it neshly?
Oh, an adverb.
No, we don't like that.
We don't do adverbs in this.
Doesn't matter. I'm not going to be using the word anyway.
No, me neither. I stick up for adverbs.
Okay, thank you, Teresa. And now, as promised at the beginning, we're going to have a discussion about show. Don't tell. Stephanie is going to lead us in that.
Well, Anton Chekhov made a very famous comment, which is often offered in terms of show, don't tell. He said, "Don't tell me the moon is shining. Show me the glint of light on broken glass." Mm. If you just close your eyes for a moment and think of the image of a glint of light on broken glass, it's actually quite evocative, isn't it? It gives you much more of a sense of place than just to say, oh, the moon was shining.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because if you've got broken glass, that suggests that...
It's a bit edgy, isn't it?
Yes. Mm. Yes. So the reason that we want to show and not tell is because, really, we're using words to create a picture, to paint a picture in the reader's mind, rather than telling them what the picture is. So we're asking them to create the picture. And if we can do that, we engage them more deeply and get them really invested in the story. Now, Ernest Hemingway, just to quote another quote on Show Not Tell, Ernest Hemingway said, "Show the readers everything, tell them nothing." Mm. I'm not sure I agree with that, because I think telling does have a place, because there are times when we do have to give the reader information. And I find myself that I like it best when there's a blend.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you an example of the difference between telling and showing, if you said John was afraid he'd be late, so he ran for the bus but missed it, he was having a bad day, there's a lot of telling there.
Yeah.
I've not asked the reader to infer anything. Whereas if I said, "Damn it," said John, looking at the town hall clock, "he broke into a run and reached the bus stop just as the number 26 pulled away."
Mm-hmm.
I'm asking you there to infer that he's late. I haven't told you he's late, but he said, "Damn it," as he looked at the clock.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And he runs to the bus stop and misses the bus.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I haven't actually said he missed the bus. I've just said the bus is pulling.
Right.
Now, consider this one. "Damn it," said John, as the town hall clock loomed over him. His train has pounded the pavement, slipping on wet leaves as he turned the corner to see the back of the number 26 bus leaving his stop. His breath formed clouds in the air.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
That tells us more, doesn't it?
It tells you the season, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it's also quite, you know, the town clock is looming. His feet are pounding. There's more urgency and anxiety there as well. Yeah,
right.
And the wet leaves.
It's almost threat, isn't it?
Yeah.
And his breath forming clouds maybe suggests he's panting.
Yes.
Because he's run.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also we have the feeling that it's really important to catch the bus. You know, it could be. He could be being pursued by somebody with an axe or, you know.
As I heard you read it, I was thinking that leaving the bus stop bit was a bit superfluous, because just seeing the back of the bus is enough.
You're absolutely right.
It gives an indication there as well about age, because if he's running for the bus, you're not going to talk about an elderly, infirm person. You're talking about a younger person. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the sneakers bear that out as well.
So the difference between showing and telling, and everybody's always asking this, but simply telling is supplying information and showing is asking the reader to work it out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to say John was tall, that's telling you, but you could think of another way. How would you ask the reader, perhaps?
Well, I was talking to someone 6'5" in the supermarket the other day, and my neck was craned backwards.
Exactly.
Welcome to my world.
Yes. Yeah. Say, John swore as his head struck the... top of the
lintel.
Yes,
lintel.
Exactly.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
The door facing on the top.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, that's what lintel is.
And what about Phyllis was angry?
Mm.
Yes.
Phyllis. Phyllis's eyes bulged as she clenched her fists.
Yeah.
She trembled.
Mm. Two red spots appeared in her cheeks.
Yeah.
So you're asking the reader to form an opinion, to infer the situation from...
Yeah.
So, you know, tired people aren't just tired. They don't just look tired.
Mm-hmm.
They yawn, they stretch, they rub their eyes,
they stretch their back, they have
dark circles.
Yeah.
And dialogue can be quite useful for showing. You know, you could have someone saying, "God, you look rough. Did you not sleep last night?" That would suggest they're looking tired.
That's right.
Okay, so some other ones then, you know, the husband comes home from work and the wife says, "Oh, the children were very demanding today."
I'm trying hard to imagine that scenario.
Whereas if your character says, you know, he comes in and says, "Hello, darling, what sort of day have you had?" And she says, "Well, if I'm not wiping a nose or a bottom, I'm shoveling food into mouths," and which they only then spit all over the floor, and then I've got to clear it up.
Yeah.
Getting much more of a sense. You don't have to say... "The children were very demanding," she said. She was obviously cross and frustrated.
But also, if you say the children were very demanding, it doesn't actually tell you anything.
No. But she really gets a sense from her dialogue, you get a sense of how she's feeling.
She threw the baked bee can across saucepan across the room and dumped a filthy nappy in his hand before walking off without saying
Exactly. Yeah. So it does often mean using more words than you might have done to say Phyllis was cross.
Yeah.
But those words should wield a lot more power.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to say Bob was scared, you say Bob's face paled, his breath came in ragged gasps and so on. So I've taken some examples from our own work in the last few weeks, which I thought we might have a little play with and maybe do a little exercise. And you at home can join us in this too. So from the episode that we did last week on writing groups, when we heard from Heather, there was a paragraph early on in her piece. It's about Emma, if you remember. And Emma was an old lady who was one day surprised by a knock at the door. And then the sentence said, "The door was knocked again. And she," that is Emma, "she worried that whoever it was would give up and go before she could get to the door, as even with the help of her frame, she moved very slowly." So let's just take a moment to think about how we might make that more show and less tell. And earlier today, Nicola, you talked about Abha crept quickly through the forest, pulling her reluctant little brother, Mahendra. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a way we could make Mahendra reluctant without telling the reader he's reluctant. And in my own work, Grace was unconvinced, although unnerved by the doctor's passion.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much telling you how Grace is feeling, not asking you to infer. Okay. So should we take a few minutes and see if we can rewrite one or two or all of those sentences, depending on we don't want to take forever, but you know, we just have a few minutes to do that. All right, has everybody got something to offer?
Yeah.
Okay, who wants to go first?
I had a little go at Heather's piece about Emma, and I said, "Emma lifted her walking frame barely an inch, dropped it, shuffled forward, then repeated the process. 'I'm coming,' she called. 'Please wait.'"
And I introduced dialogue as well in a very similar way. "I'm coming, please don't go."
Yeah. And the verb shuffled.
Shuffled,
rather than moved slowly. Because in the original it said she moved very slowly, which was moved being the verb, very being an intensifier, and slowly being an adverb. And by saying shuffled, we've actually got moved very slowly, the sense of it.
And I think some people, as they get older, do get afraid to lift their feet and lose contact with the ground.
I think so.
Which makes them push their feet. Anybody else have a go at that one?
I've come up with something for Mahendra.
Right.
"Mahendra's heels dragged through the loamy forest floor as Abha pulled him along in her wake."
Very good.
I did a Mahendra one. I've got Abha crept quickly through the forest, Mahendra's weight dragging her arm behind her.
Very good. I don't know if you can creep quickly now. I might have to change that phrase. That's annoying me now.
Yeah.
Well, quickly crept is obviously the verb is being modified by the adverb. Quickly. Crept quickly.
I don't think she needs to creep quickly at all. I think she just needs to creep.
Yeah.
My attempt, I don't think, was as good as either of those, but I've got Arba pulled her brother's hand. Lift your feet, Mahendra, or we'll never get there. Mahendra pouted and hung back.
Yeah, well, that was good.
Well, that tells us he was reluctant,
right? Well, I worked on Emma's being worried a bit, and I said that she knit her brows, her lips were pursed as she pushed hard at the frame, which caused it to move clumsily along, clumsily.
Yeah. So it's a big effort,
Something's coming about her wrestling the frame, you know, like having a life of its own.
Effort that she's making to get to the bottom of the floor. Which tells us that she's anxious, she's worried, she wants to get there on time.
Right.
And it allows the reader to paint, to build that picture for themselves. Does anybody do my one?
I didn't get Grace to that one.
I had a little go at the front. The front bit was something to do with him, his spittle spraying over her as he shouted passionately. But I got stuck on the second bit.
I was hoping that you'd sort that one out for
me. I just thought like a body language thing, like raised her eyebrows.
Shrugged, rolled her eyes.
I always think of it just kind of putting her head to one side and back,
whatever.
Like what?
Although okay and whatever would not.
No. She's anxious, isn't she? She's not feeling too confident in this situation.
You could have one of her voices expressing the disbelief.
Oh, yeah, you could.
Yes, my voices are very handy for showing and not telling.
Blue can roll her eyes and be cynical about it.
Blue quite a lot actually stands in the background sort of going, what's he on about? You know, doing a circle round her ears and So we've got lots of different techniques there, but the other one I just want to cover before we sort of recap is how showing can reduce ambiguity. So you can say she was an attractive, well-groomed lady with impeccable manners. But that's really, because that's open to interpretation, sometimes you need to give more specific detail. So she wore a navy blazer over a linen dress. Her leather handbag sported a little Scotty dog. And she shifted it onto her shoulder as she extended her manicured hand and met his eyes and said, so pleased to meet you, Gavin. That gives you much more of a sense of an attractive, well-groomed woman with impeccable manners, I would argue.
Because well-groomed is open to interpretation.
Exactly. So if it's important that the reader gets an absolutely clear idea of what this person looks like, maybe be very specific.
I think we all sometimes are a little bit lazy, aren't we? And do those kind of things, grooming. Like just saying, "Well, grooming, definitely." You looking at me? I just mean those things like saying somebody is good looking, attractive, whatever. That's not a description. It's very open to interpretation, and maybe sometimes you want the reader to create their own idea and image,
if you're saying someone is well groomed, and apparently this woman was very attractive, Mamie Eisenhower was well groomed, but she doesn't look like that.
They're not the same thing. Also, I don't particularly like where you get a lot of description about a person's appearance, and I suppose the way you know they're attractive is if you see people being attracted to them.
People's reactions.
You lent me a book which was How Not to Write a Novel, which laugh out loud funny when one of the things it goes into quite a lot is how to talk about this thing of attractiveness and how to, you know, you mustn't do a list of what you could do a list of what a short list of perhaps three things that she was wearing that shows she was well groomed, but you mustn't then go into a list of three or four things that he's wearing that show Gavin is also well groomed. Gets like an inventory. But paradoxically, that was one of the things in Bright Lights, Big City. Jay McHenry?
McHenry.
And he was it him that did it, or was it the one about the psycho killer in New York? Anyway, one of those two books had
lost.
It was either Bright Lights, Big City, or the other one about American Psycho.
Yeah. Oh, American
might have been
Psycho.
American Psycho,
okay.
where he actually made a point of listing what the psycho killer was wearing on every occasion, yeah. and it just became part of the story.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I find it quite annoying in. The Millennium Trilogy, the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Oh, yes.
And things.
Mm, yes.
He does a lot of this where he'll say, she got up in the morning, pulled on her leather trousers, she had a slice of rye toast, how she had her coffee, on a spit coffee table from IKEA, yes. with overlooked by a Sven lamp or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I find that tedious padding.
Especially she wears the same clothes every day.
But, you know, there's an awful lot of that and some... I can't remember, but a well-known novelist who writes thrillers that I don't like tells you every morsel of food and every mouthful of drink that the heroine has and the dog, what she feeds the dog. And as far as I'm concerned, it's padding. It's not anything.
I mean, when John goes to catch the bus, you could say, John opened the door, checked his watch, locked the front door, opened the gate, went through the gate, walked up, realised he was going to be late, hurried up.
Yeah.
But it, like you say, it's tedious and dull, whereas if you can just give the impression that John's suddenly realised that he's going to be late. Yeah. We don't need to know. We have to assume he got up this morning, had a shower, had his breakfast, got dressed, left the house and was clothed by the time he left.
Yeah.
We don't have to say, one morning John got up, got dressed, had a shower, got dressed, had his coffee and some porridge.
And also, tell me the clothing if it's relevant, like the well-groomed lady with the linen, the blazer and the linen dress and the designer handbag. I get that, but it's just a few little insights. We don't need to know everything. We don't need to know the shoes and the hat. You know, it's just those details that tell you.
Yeah. From the underwear out, we don't need it.
No.
Just to summarise really then, the kind of four key things that will help us show and not tell.
Mm-hmm.
Use strong, specific words so that we can avoid using adverbs. Although, you know, again, we're never going to get rid of adverbs completely, but instead of saying somebody walked quickly, which is walked being the verb, quickly being the adverb that modifies the verb, we can say that they ran or
hurried,
skipped or hurried or, yes, all sorts of, there's all sorts of stronger verbs that we can use there. So that's one thing, use strong, specific verbs. Second thing I'd say would be provoke emotions through character reactions, body language, vivid writing. So, you know, if a character gasps when somebody says something, you don't have to say he was shocked.
No.
You can say he gasped. And that may tell you that he was shocked.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Did you get that?
Surprised.
Surprised. And and body language, you know,
right.
A wide open mouth and wide open eyes are going to tell you something.
Yeah.
I remember in your piece that you read a month or so ago, Nicola, when you had people being...
in the
terrified.
We talked about
you had some great terrified looks on their faces, and we said at the time you don't have to tell us they're scared because you've shown us so well. You know, it was teeth were bared and eyes were
fists
wide
were
open. All of that.
Right.
So body language and vivid writing will provoke emotion. Use well placed details, like specific minute details, to bring a scene to life. So, you know, like you say, the back of the bus or the the label on the inside of somebody's jacket that says Armani, or, you know, that's just glimpsed as they shrug it off. Or the fingernails, or, you know, if they're dirty or clean, or, you know, the long hair on the witch's chin.
Yeah.
You know?
That says witch without you saying anything else, doesn't
the long hair on the chin. Absolutely.
Don't look at me like that.
No, I was putting it on my own chin.
Yeah. Yes. Not a witch.
And finally, the other thing we talked about was expressive dialogue. And I love the expression, let the dialogue speak for itself.
Mm. Yeah, very nice. Very
clever. Because if we have people saying the right things, then that will show how they're feeling.
Yeah. Right.
I think I'm finally getting it, ladies.
I really hope that you can help me with the Grace looking unconvinced.
We'll work on that.
No, I'm talking to our Facebook people. Maybe you could go on to the Facebook group and help me out with that one.
Right.
Because I would really like to know how Grace can be unconvinced, although unnerved, by the Doctor's passion. So help me out, please, guys.
Or start a thread with your own bit of telling and challenge everybody else to make a show of it.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
That would be fun. Yes, do that, please.
Well, thank you.
Start it off.
Well, thank you, Steph. It's a very good discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, very helpful.
Thank you for that, Steph. That would be very helpful.
I just hope I can practice what I preach. You'll be looking out for me.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We'll bring you down on that.
And now, we've almost reached the end of this podcast. But first, before we go, Kirsten Pell and Heather are going to tell us what they're reading now. Kirsten?
The book I'm reviewing is The Versions of Us by Lorna Barnett. This book was recommended to me by my sister, and I listened to it on Audible. It's three versions of one relationship between Eva and Jim, who meet in 1958 at age 19 at Cambridge. It then follows them until they're in their 70s. In the first version, Eva is seeing David Katz, an ambitious, handsome actor set on world domination. And like the movie Sliding Doors, one event is pivotal. Eva falling from her bicycle when a dog runs out in front of her. Jim sees her and they meet. From this point, the three tales diverge. Each version shares common elements. Their mutual attraction and desire to be together. The fact that Eva is a writer and Jim, a painter at heart. Like the romance, though, their career paths vary considerably in all three versions. And Barnett looks at the impact, chance, and different outcomes can have on a relationship. How resentments and thwarted ambition can impact. How sometimes love isn't enough. I really, really enjoyed this book. When I started it, I couldn't stop. I was listening to it as much as I could manage. It's a wonderful debut. The Times described it as the beautiful love child of David Nicholls' One Day and Kate Atkinson's Life After Life, which I think sums it up really, really well. I highly recommend it.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Heather, what's on your bedside table?
The Secret Life of Bees by Sue Monk Kidd. Set in South Carolina in 1964, The Secret Life of Bees tells the story of Lily Owens, whose life has been shaped around the blurred memory of the afternoon her mother was killed. When Lily's fierce-hearted black stand-in mother insults three of the deepest racists in town, Lily decides to spring them both free. The escape to... Now, I'm not quite sure how you do say it. Tiburon, South Carolina, a town that holds a secret to her mother's past. Taken in by an eccentric trio of beekeeping sisters, Lily is introduced to their mesmerising world of bees and honey and the Black Madonna. Wow. It's a remarkable novel about divine female power, a story women will share and pass on to their daughters for years to come. And I just can't wait to read the rest of the book. I want to go to bed. I'll go now. Read it again. And interestingly, it tells of a white girl in the black community and the prejudice the white girl receives.
It's
fascinating to read things that way.
I've read it and I can only recommend it.
I'd like to read it.
Confirm what you said. Yeah. It's a lovely, lovely book.
Yes.
Add it to my pile, I know.
Add it to your Ballycumbers.
I will add it to your Ballycumbers.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Heather. And that was Sue Monk Kidd, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of another podcast, and we've had fun. I hope you've had fun listening. Go to Write Club the Podcast on Facebook and join our group. Also, subscribe to iTunes or Stitcher so every new show will automatically be delivered wherever you want it. Tell a friend about us so you can help us grow our audience, and leave a review. Just give us some comments on how much you love us or or how what you absolutely abhor. Now, you can help us grow by letting us know what you love or what you don't like to see. That would be helpful, too.
Yeah.
So, goodbye for now.